Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic. Hello and welcome to And Colossally That's History, the podcast that takes an unadulterated look at the earth-shattering events, epic sagas, and huge characters that have shaped motor racing history. I'm Matt Bishop, and I'm joined by my wonderful friend and co-host, Richard Williams. Richard, this is exciting, isn't it? We're doing a podcast.
It's extremely exciting, and I know that you, like me, can't wait to start bringing some amazing stories to our listeners.
Indeed so. So I suppose, as this is the first episode, we should explain who we are. As I said, I'm Matt Bishop, and I've worked in motorsport for many years as a journalist, a magazine editor, and for my sins, a communications chief for the McLaren and Aston Martin Formula One teams, and now as the boss of my own comms PR agency, Diagonal Comms. What's your excuse for being here, Richard?
Well, I'm Richard Williams, and I'm an author, journalist, and broadcaster, and I've written books on the likes of Ayrton Senna, Enzo Ferrari, Stirling Moss, and the Le Mans 24 Hours, to name just a few. And like you, Matt, I've also been present at many of the races and events we'll inevitably end up talking about.
You certainly have, and I've seen you at many of them, and I've read many of your books, and some of them are extremely good, old boy.
How kind.
Anyway, I think that makes us qualified to host a podcast about motor racing history, although I say it myself on behalf of both of us. But we should probably explain a little bit more about the podcast itself, shouldn't we? Starting with why it's called what it's called.
The motor racing aficionados out there may already have guessed what's inspired the name of our podcast. But for the uninitiated, it's a riff on one of the most famous bits of commentary delivered by the late, great Murray Walker, when Nigel Mansell's tyre dramatically exploded during the 1986 F1 title showdown in Adelaide.
Are you going to attempt an impersonation of that, Richard?
I am not, but I'm counting on you for those things.
And colossally, that's Mansell.
4 out of 10.
I'm accepting 4 out of 10, but at least it might remind anybody who's heard it that that is what we're alluding to.
Move over. And look at that! Out that, and colossally, that's Mansell. That is Nigel Mansell.
Anyway, as for the podcast itself, it's quite a simple premise, really. Each episode, we'll discuss and dissect one topic from motor racing history. It could be a specific moment, a special character, driver, team boss, an unforgettable race. You get the idea. Along the way, we'll tell plenty of stories and hopefully in the process explain how motor racing moved from a niche pastime, which is what it was, to the multi-billion dollar sporting spectacle we all watch today.
And when we say history, we're not just talking about stuff from the days of black and white TV. We're talking about everything from the earliest days of motor racing right up to today. And on that note, our first episode is rather a modern story, isn't it? In fact, some might argue it's the greatest sporting fairy tale of the 21st century so far.
Some might indeed argue that, and it seems odd to think about 2009 as history, but it is history. And on today's episode, we're talking about Brawn Grand Prix and its remarkable Formula One championship double in 2009, when the team rose from near total oblivion to capture the sport's most prestigious titles, drivers and constructors, Formula One, all in the space of 10 months.
I'm sure many of our listeners will have watched the Brawn GP documentary series on Disney Plus, but we think there's quite a bit more to be said. For example, Matt, at the time you were working in F1 with McLaren, who'd won the world title with Lewis Hamilton only the season before. So, do you remember Brawn's story as the rest of us do, as this incredible fairy tale, or do you have a more nuanced view?
Probably a bit of both, I'd say. I mean, it was a fairy tale. But I'm going to take us back just even to a little while before, because I think it's useful background. I'm taking us back to Melbourne 2007. Now, if you remember, the team then that became Brawn, which was then called Honda, they produced this ridiculous car, really. My Earth Dream, it was called, if you remember.
I do.
Yeah. With grotesque livery.
Utterly.
Utterly grotesque livery.
With, of course, the best of intentions.
The best of intentions, and therefore I didn't slag it off when I was, because I was a journalist back in those days. I was writing for and editing F1 Racing magazine. So I thought it would be churlish to give it a slating, but secretly I thought it was a bit silly. For those who don't remember or don't know, it was the whole car was painted as though it were a depiction of planet Earth with countries and sea, so green and brown. And
so it was a save the planet thing.
Save the planet thing, yes. Anyway, it was my Earth dream, but my track nightmare, because it was a terrible car. And I remember interviewing Jenson Button, who, of course, was one of the drivers, in Melbourne, in the paddock, in 2007. And if you remember, he'd won his first race the year before, yep. And he was the coming man, or one of the coming men in that sense. And it's probably the closest, or the first time, anyway, I encountered a driver who, and I'm going to use a powerful word, really, depressed. I looked at him and I thought, this young man is depressed. Mm. Because he realised that here we are at the very, very start of what he had hoped would be a good season, because of the promise shown the previous year, and he was ready for a long slog in a terrible car. Mm. And he was depressed. And it became quite clear that he was right. The car was bad. You recall 2007. You remember how bad the car was at that time. And it became quite clear that something had to be done. And towards the end of that year, they hired Ross Brawn, which, of course, was a massively important hiring.
Yeah. And Ross was just coming off a sabbatical, having taken Ferrari to umpteen championships with Michael Schumacher.
Exactly.
And Benetton before that.
Probably at that time, and indeed in history, one of the most successful team bosses that had been at that time and still ever has been. You know, right up there with the greats, a great himself. And clearly that got everyone's attention. Anyway, he arrived at the end of 2007. When he got there, of course, he was a boss, but he was also an engineer. And I think he took one look at the car that they had planned for 2008 and thought, this is not going to be much better. Mm-hmm. It was a development of what was already, to use a technical term, a shitbox. And I think he thought, no. So he did something very revolutionary, radical, and courageous, which is he more or less shelved the 2008 car and said, no, we're going to steal an advantage by writing off 2008 and using the industrial and technical might of Honda to develop the 2009 car from the beginning of 2008, steal an advantage. And this is what he did do. And as a result, in some ways, we'll come to the why it ended up being called a Brawn. But of course, at that point, the 2009 car was regarded as and was intended to be a Honda. It was probably the most expensively developed F1 car of all time at that point, developed in not only the UK, but also Japan. I think at one time they had four different wind tunnels.
Yeah, they certainly had three. They had a very, very good one at Braun itself, and they had a couple of others, one at Super Aguri and one, maybe they were using the Williams wind tunnel as well.
But they also had one in Japan,
yeah,
which they didn't talk much about.
Yeah. And Honda were putting hundreds of millions of pounds into the team at that point. So for Ross to persuade them that, look, 2008 isn't going to be such a great year, took some doing.
It did take some doing. Anyway, 2008, as a result, was not a particularly good year. Kel surprise. They weren't, for the team, yeah, we're talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway, they might therefore have had a great car for 2009 anyway, had Honda remained, but probably not quite as good as they did have. Because the irony and the astonishing double whammy, if you like, is that the weak link of the car was its engine. Hmm. That's the one thing about that car that wasn't great. And of course, in the end, what happened is that it ended up having a Mercedes engine, which was the best engine at the time. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I remember it towards the end of 2008, obviously that was the financial crisis. We had BMW sliding out of the sport. Toyota lasted one more year, but the writing was probably on the wall. And then I remember, you remember Pino Elievi.
Very well, of the Gazzetta dello Sport, the
yes,
great correspondent.
I mean, veteran, I think, are we allowed to say, despite the fact that he's not that much older than you, old boy?
How kind.
Anyway, he reported on Formula One from the late 60s and was a buddy of Enzo Ferrari. And really one of the most well-connected Italian journalists there's ever been. Anyway, I was at McLaren at the time, as you say, as director of communications. And Pino called me. I remember I was sitting in my office at the McLaren Technology Center in Woking. And Pino called me and he said, what's going on with Honda? And I happened to know that the announcement of closure was going to be made the following day, Honda pulling out. And I've known Pino for a long time. Now, it wasn't my business to pass on this information. On the other hand, I'd known him for a long time. I liked him. I respected him. And to be honest, I didn't think I'd be connected to the information being passed to him. Nobody knew that he would be calling me. And it wasn't about my team. It was about a different team. And I didn't want to lie to him, because the worst comms initiative you can ever do is a lie, a porky pie. And it just doesn't work apart from anything else. Apart from being the wrong thing to do in life, it also doesn't work, because a journalist says, well, I'm not asking him again, because he told me a lie last time. So try not to lie is my advice to any comms executives listening. Anyway, I tried to live by that. And so I said to Pino, I said, well, Pino, actually, it's funny you should ring this evening, because it's closing. And he said, so yeah, he didn't understand. I mean, he speaks good English, but he just wasn't ready for that very, very final, literally final piece of information. So he said, so what is happening? What is happening? I said, it's closing, mate. It's closing. So what the news? I said, I remember saying, chiuso, chiuso, which is one of the few words of Italian
close,
I know.
Close.
And then he said, chiuso? I said, sì, chiuso, finito. Anyway, he then wrote it, and of course the next day it was announced.
And may I say, your Pino Elievi impersonation is better than your Murray Walker.
Well, so a much smaller percentage of viewers can corroborate that. And listeners, sorry, I should say. Anyway, what then happened? So they'd made this brilliant car. They'd taken 2 years uniquely to develop this brilliant car. But it now suddenly looked like it might never have a chance to race because Honda had pulled out. Chiuso. Mm. So, what happened? Well, actually, what might have happened is that the team may well have ceased to trade, and that car might have been stillborn. It might have been one of those cars that we never knew. And, you know, there would have been redundancies. There would have been... what would have happened to Jenson Button? Would Rubens Barrichello have retired?
And this was November 2008, so it was on the eve of the season. Everybody had made their arrangements for 2009. They'd have been left high and dry, as would the 719 people who worked at the factory in Brackley. And Honda were prepared to close the whole thing down and pay everybody off, weren't they? And they wanted to stop paying. Basically, their total F1 budget was about $750 million a year. And they just wanted to stop doing that because of what had happened with the world financial crisis.
Yeah, and was it 719 people? Actually,
it was 719.
Yeah, well, it's and it wasn't because they didn't believe in their Formula One program. It was because of the global situation, yeah. and what we didn't then call probably, but now would call the optics.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so what then happened? Well, back to McLaren, which is where I was working, and if you remember, this is the end of 2008. We're talking about, as you say, Richard, November 2008. But during 2008 had been formed FOTA, Formula One Teams Association. And the first chairman was Luca di Montezemolo. And the first secretary general was his friend, do you remember Simone Pirello?
Yes.
Yeah, who they worked in Italian politics before and since.
Luca was the president of Ferrari at the time.
He was, of course. And so they formed FOTA and all the teams joined forces. And I was working at McLaren, and Martin Whitmarsh was the team principal of McLaren. And, you know, McLaren was winning the world championship in 2008 and was then and now, but probably even more then than now, one of the biggest and most successful teams. Ron was still there, albeit Ron Dennis as chairman. Martin Whitmarsh had taken on the team principal role. And Martin, who I've worked with, by the way, at McLaren and also more recently at Aston Martin, he wanted to be team principal and he was team principal. But I think actually I can now say he was probably also eyeing the chairmanship of FOTA, Formula One Teams Association. He saw himself as other than Luca di Montezemolo, who is obviously a legend of the sport then and now. I think Martin saw himself as perhaps primus inter pares, first among equals, compared with some of the others, and was a capable statesman-like person. So rather than accepting that it's really unfortunate, but it looks like the team at Brackley is going to bite the dust, very unfortunate, let's have a look if there are any good engineers we should poach or any good commercial people or any good mechanics or anything like that, which is probably what Ron Dennis would have done, super competitive and very pragmatic. Martin, with an eye on the FOTA chairmanship as well as his role at McLaren as team principal, decided that he wanted to try to intervene, which, by the way, I'm not criticising, is probably the best for the sport as a global outlook for Formula One, because it prevented the dissolution and disappearance of a team and all those jobs, 719 jobs, as you say, Richard. So he actually flew to Stuttgart personally, not to beg, but to persuade the boss of Daimler, yep, AG at the time, to supply the team that we thought was still called Honda but might be going to bite the dust. Anyway, that was a strange thing to do in some ways, because at that time McLaren was the only team supplied by Mercedes, I think I'm right, mm-hmm, am I not? And therefore McLaren, it was Vodafone, McLaren, Mercedes, and it was seen as Mercedes works team. So in a sense, what Whitmarsh was doing was interceding in a way that would benefit a team that would actually be a rival of the team of which he was team principal and paid by.
Yeah.
And at the time, it's years ago, so I think I can say, I remember walking along the elevated walkway in the very fancy Cathedral to Speed, which is the McLaren Technology Centre in Woking, and walking along with the chief legal officer, Tim Manane, who still there, by the way, still there. And he'd been there already a long time in 2009. So he's a real McLaren veteran and stalwart. And people who don't work in Formula One teams don't realise the really very significant influence that the chief legal officer and the chief financial officer have. You know, they don't get interviewed on the race. They don't go to races. They don't interact with media. Fans might not necessarily know who they are, but they have fiduciary responsibility and they're on the board. And I remember Tim just saying, what is happening? What is Martin doing? Mm. Martin is eroding our position as the works, or as near as damn it, works Mercedes team in order to bolster a rival that we need to beat. And he was tetchy about it and very forthright, because that's the nature of the man. And I hadn't really focused on it, but he was right in a way. But I don't know what you think, Richard. I mean, from the point of McLaren, it was a mistake. But the point of the sport, it was the good thing for Martin to do.
Yes, it was. Ross Brawn and Nick Fry, his partner in what was going to be the new team, they didn't have an engine. Honda wouldn't let them carry on with their engine. So they had a choice between Mercedes and Ferrari. And Ross knew from his experience at Ferrari that if they said yes to Ferrari, then they'd be getting last year's engine and they wouldn't be getting new bits and, you know, it just wouldn't be as good. And anyway, the Ferrari engine didn't fit the chassis that they'd already got, which they designed for the Honda engine. It would have had to have been redesigned. But the Mercedes engine, rather miraculously, did fit. So when Whitmarsh made that grand diplomatic gesture, then it worked very much to the new team's interest. I mean, you know, they paid 8 million quid for the engines for the season, which is a bit of a bargain, really, when you think the quality.
It was the best engine at the time.
It was, and they worked out eventually when they got the thing running that it was a second a lap faster than the Honda, which they would have, you know, they would have had Honda not disappeared. So in that way, it was also great for them.
So they couldn't have won the 2009 championship with Honda.
Nope.
And they couldn't have won the 2009 championship without Honda.
No, they wouldn't have won it as Honda, for sure. I mean, they'd have performed. They'd have performed better than they had in 2008, no question. But actually, Ross thought afterwards that perhaps by writing off the 2008 season in order to try and ensure some degree of success for the 2009 car, that might have discouraged some people on the Honda board a bit. They might have thought, well, you know, we haven't done much this season. I know he said that, but, you know, even so, we should have been doing better. So really, by closing the whole thing, we're not losing that much. You know, we're not losing face in the same way.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was complicated. Complicated.
It was business. Complicated and. But anyway, the outcome was a brilliant car that had been designed with the, as I say, technical and industrial might of Honda, into which had been plopped the best engine worth a second a lap, as you say. So best of both worlds. And then we started testing. And I remember, as a McLaren person at that time, seeing the Brawn. By the way, it was only called Brawn in early March.
Yeah.
That's when the team was formed. Yeah. I mean, lastminute.com.
Yes.
Absolutely. And they went to, must have been Barcelona, I suppose.
They missed Bahrain. They missed the first test completely. Right. They just weren't ready. Then they turned up at Barcelona and were immediately a second and a half a lap quicker than anybody.
You were at that test, were you?
Yes, I was. I was briefly at that test.
Do you remember, because I was sitting in my office in Woking, looking at the times coming up and thinking, oh, obvious. They're running it on a splash of fuel in order to get some sponsorship because their backs are to the wall. But in Barcelona, what was the vibe and the mood?
Well, I think that's what everybody suspected they were doing. You know, they had no significant sponsors at that point. So that's what you do, isn't it? You know, you run the car practically dry to show some good times and tell sponsors that you're going to be very successful. Well, they weren't doing that at all. You know, they were running on kind of normal fuel loads. And Jensen, in the end, said, well, he wasn't even having to try and push the thing particularly hard in order to be as fast as that. It was phenomenal. And, of course, the reason for it was the famous double diffuser, which had been designed into the car during 2008 when they were planning for the season to come.
Now, there's interesting background to the double diffuser, which has been endlessly discussed, but I'm just going to tell a little bit of background again from my perspective at McLaren at the time. If you recall, at that time, because the regulations changed for 2009, the technical regulations. And in 2008, there was a thing called the Overtaking Working Group. And that was senior technical people from three teams, if you like, the three most successful top teams at that time, which was Ferrari, McLaren and Renault. So the senior people, and McLaren, my colleague at the time, was Paddy Lowe. And he used to come back from their meetings and brief me off the record, not for sharing with journalists. I'd say, you know, what's the OWG, as we called it, Overtaking Working Group, what's the latest? And he said, oh, I think it's going to be good. They're going to be able to overtake each other. It's going to make the greatest racing. And again, in the same way as Whitmarsh, Martin Whitmarsh was perhaps not only motivated by a desire to see McLaren succeed solely, but also perhaps to do the greater thing for Formula One in general and be a good Formula One citizen and perhaps get himself the photo chairmanship at the same time. So also, I think Paddy and the other senior technical people at Ferrari and Renault wanted to make sure that the work they'd been doing on the Overtaking Working Group was going to be successful and the cars were going to succeed and be able to overtake each other. Now, in the course of their work, one of the things they had to do was model and project and therefore predict the amount of downforce, points of downforce, and therefore ultimately the pace, the lap time of generally what cars would be doing in 2009. And perhaps a bit arrogantly, but Formula One people are arrogant, particularly if they work for big teams. And we're talking about Ferrari, McLaren and Renault were the biggest teams at the time, most successful teams at the time. They thought if our engineers are coming out with this number of points of downforce and this lap time, nobody's going to beat us. So that's what it's going to be. That's a good yardstick going forward. Therefore, they, I'm not saying stopped, but slightly diluted, in my humble opinion, slightly diluted what is usually a relentless effort, which is to continue to find new points of downforce and more performance. Because once they'd achieved that, which they had thought would be the target which would then make the cars overtake each other, they didn't have the same psychological drive to continue to push past 11 o'clock at night, get in the next morning at 5 in the morning and go again, which is what Formula One teams do. So they didn't think of the double diffuser, but three teams did. Because don't forget, it wasn't just Honda that became Braun. It was also Toyota and Williams that also thought of it, which Ferrari, McLaren and Renault had written off as comparative midfielders that won't trouble the scorers, certainly won't trouble us. So when the car seemed to be actually genuinely quick, when the long run pace was shown, of course, the technical people at Ferrari, McLaren and Renault were up in arms. This is cheating. But tell me, do you think it was cheating? Do you think?
I've been thinking about it. And a saying from, do you remember the engineer Frank Durney, who worked for Williams for a long
Certainly.
Time and other many other
teams? And in fact, Toyota at that time as well.
He did,
yes.
And Frank said about the double diffuser, he said, you know, when somebody said, well, it's not within the spirit of F1. And Frank said, well, the spirit of F1 is that clever people beat stupid people. And that really sums it up. So if it's within the letter of the law, which it was found to be, then it's legal. You know, I mean, it went to the FIA, it went to the FIA's Court of Appeal and was found to be legal. And that's what made Braun's success in 2009 possible. But it was a brilliant thing. I mean, it had come from a fairly junior Japanese aerodynamicist called Masayuki Minagawa, who was working on behalf of Honda at the, when the team was still Honda. And he brought the idea and said, well, you know, there's this, there are these new rules, but I think I've maybe found a little, actually a literal loophole, you know, an extra hole in the bodywork of the car that would restore some of the downforce. And Loic Biguat, who was the Honda team's chief aerodynamicist in Brackley, worked on it, and it was designed into the 09 car. And, of course, they kept quiet about it, except Ross did go to a meeting of the technical working group where all the representatives of all the teams were there. And he said, well, you know, we've been told that these new rules will be cutting the downforce by 50%. I think I've found a way to get it back up to 100%. He told them that. He didn't tell them how it had been done. But apparently they didn't take it very seriously. Those grandee teams you were talking about, McLaren, Renault, Ferrari, didn't take him seriously. They didn't believe it. Sam Michael at Williams did take it seriously, which may have been why Williams developed very quickly a double diffuser. He worked out what it was. And Toyota were also thinking along the same lines. But you have to say Toyota and Williams, you know, were nowhere near as successful as the team that became Braun would be.
Absolutely. Listen, just remind me, what was the quote you gave there of Frank Derny about Formula One?
The spirit of Formula One is that clever people beat stupid people.
I think on that note, we should go to an ad break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Here we are back again after that little break. What we were talking about, we were talking about double diffusers, were we not? And it did strike me that we haven't actually explained in any detail really what they are. And since neither of us is an engineer,
neither of us has designed a race winning Formula One car,
so I'm going to ask you to take on that little task of explaining.
Thank you, Matt. Well, basically, as I see it, and where is Ross Braun when you need him? The diffuser is the thing at the back of the car that affects the flow of air out from the back of the car and thus the downforce at the rear and thus the speed at which the car is capable and grip and so on. They'd come up with this double diffuser idea, which is like having an extra slot for the air to come out. And this one was in actually the rear bodywork of the car. And it sort of doubled the downforce effect. So restored the downforce that the FIA had tried to take away in order to get the cars to overtake each other more easily. So that's a very, very, very rough idea of what a double diffuser is.
Well, you gave me 4 out of 10 for my Murray Walker impression. So I'll give you 5 out of 10 for that.
Generous. But the thing was, when it was obvious that this car, which was now called the Braun GP that this car was uncommonly quick and quicker than anything else around. Of course, everybody tried to find out what it was, what they'd done, and it became obvious that it was, you know, something to do with the multiple diffuser at the back. So the other teams, you know, sent their digital photographers around to try and get shots of it. And so Ross Brawn ordered his mechanics always to stand around the back of the car so nobody could take a clear photograph of it when it was at rest, and to try and keep the secret for as long as possible. And that was still going on when we all went to Melbourne for the first race of the season, the Australian Grand Prix.
Absolutely. And as you say, you know, secrecy, technical and commercial secrets in Formula One are, you know, legendary in terms of how carefully they're kept. And when something like that has happened, you know, a magic bullet, and they happen very rarely now, but when something has been invented by one team, the other teams either ban it or copy it, one or the other. Mm-hmm. And both of those strategies are usually prepared in parallel. So the lawyers are trying to get it banned and the engineers are copying it just in case it doesn't get banned. And of course, the grandee teams that had been the authors of the overtaking working group, whose sums had been thrown in the trash can by the double diffuser because all of their assumptions had been shown to be wrong, were trying to ban it and copy it.
Yes. And Ross had taken the design to Charlie Whiting, who at that point was the race director, and who ruled on legality of parts and cars. And Charlie had told Ross it was okay. Now, Charlie's thing was, if somebody went to him before the season with a new bit of kit and said, is this legal? If it was legal, he didn't say anything to anybody else. He kept the confidentiality. If he decided it wasn't legal, he told everybody so that they wouldn't all waste their time trying to do the same thing.
And waste their time and money,
and his time too, I guess. Yeah. But, you know, in this case, because he ruled it was legal, he kept it to himself.
Charlie Whiting, obviously, much missed race director of the FIA.
Very much missed.
Much missed.
Universally respected and liked. Yeah.
So, as you say, we got to Melbourne. I was at McLaren. Director of comms, you were in the press room.
Writing for the Guardian, yep.
Writing for the Guardian. So, Guardroom.
Groniac.
it's another Guardian literal or typo.
Guardroom, I remember that.
Guardroom. Anyway, never mind. You were writing for the Guardian and I was working for McLaren. And, well, let's have your impressions first. So, Richard Branson was there. Tell us all about it.
Well, when the race weekend started in Melbourne, the two Brawn cars ran true to the form they'd shown in the testing. Jenson Button and Rubens Barrichello were first and second in qualifying. And on the Saturday afternoon, the Melbourne paddock was suddenly invaded by Richard Branson, the chairman of Virgin Enterprises, you know, Virgin Records, Virgin Airlines, Virgin everything. And Branson had been one of those people who tried to buy the team when it became obvious that Honda were walking away. Several people came in at that point, talking to Ross Brawn and Nick Fry about taking over the team. There was a Russian oligarch.
There always is.
There is. There was a Greek fraudster. There isn't always one of those.
No.
And Vijay Mallya, I think, of Force India was interested in the team. And
Adrian Reynard was involved.
Adrian Reynard, the designer and manufacturer of racing cars himself.
And was actually a leading light of the team when it was first launched as BAR in 1999.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think he and Branson got together at one point to try and perhaps buy it together. They decided that Brawn and Fry decided that Branson wasn't the person, but he might be a source of some kind of finance for them.
He had there was a Virgin logo on the car,
wasn't
there?
There was a Virgin logo on the car. And so Richard arrived in the paddock on the Saturday afternoon. Now, I'd seen the Branson effect before at pretty close quarters. I knew him from the music business in the 70s. And then there was a boxing match, a big fight between Lennox Lewis and Frank Bruno, which was arranged for Cardiff, the old Arms Park, on a Saturday, late on a Saturday night for American TV. And I went to cover that fight. And I was leaving my hotel to go to the stadium at about 9 o'clock at night. This is a Saturday night in Cardiff, which is quite lively, generally. And I was leaving the hotel and there was Richard Branson and I knew him. So we said hello and I think he'd got his son with him, who was quite small at the time. And he said, are you going to the fight? And I said, yep. So we walked down through the middle of Cardiff on a Saturday night together. And it was astonishing. People were coming out of the pubs to shake his hand. You know, I mean, there weren't selfies in those days, but that would have been what was going on. But they were coming, oh, good old Richard, you know. Hey.
Amazing.
It was like walking with the Pied Piper. He was that famous in those days to the general public.
Did that surprise you, by the way?
It did a bit, yeah. It did. But it was pretty, pretty interesting. And anyway, that bit of that effect was apparent in Melbourne. You know, he arrived wanting to take advantage of having the Virgin logo for not very much money on the car.
I remember it. Wasn't it like $250,000 or something?
It wasn't, yeah. Something,
it was very small
sum. It was
sum.
Very small amount.
Yeah.
And some of it was given in Virgin Airline tickets, yeah. I think, you know, yeah. in kind rather than actual cash. But of course, he started referring to it as the Virgin car.
Yes.
As he would. I mean,
of
that's
course.
That's his modus operandi. And the photographer, he gave a press conference, you know, the photographers clustered around him. And he sort of, I don't think Nick Fry, you know, who was in charge of the commercial side at Braun, I don't think he minded that much because it drew a terrific amount of attention to this car. So, you know, that's what happened.
Well, I remember, I think the impression was almost deliberately given that this might become the Virgin.
Yeah.
Car and the Virgin team,
yeah.
And perhaps that would be have a honeypot effect, yeah. on other potential sponsors.
That's
absolutely even.
True. Yeah. And of course, when the cars won the race, finished first and second in their very first race, Richard was there front and centre in the celebrations.
Of course, absolutely on the telly with the spraying the champagne, doing everything.
Yeah,
yeah.
Meanwhile, all the other team principals were kind of gnashing their teeth backstage and wondering how they could. Led by Luca de Montezemolo, who was absolutely furious.
Furious. And I remember, of course, after the race, it was always my habit in those days to go onto the pit wall, cross the pit lane, and go to the pit wall, because one has to write the post-race press releases. And just check, obviously, I've watched the race, I've made notes, I've got access to the data screens as a comms director. But just talk to the team principal or any other senior engineers. Is there anything else that I might not be aware of or you think we should focus on or not reveal, etc.? So, I, as was my habit, crossed the pit lane, went onto the pit wall, walked up to what is referred to as the Pratt perch, and spoke to the Pratts and asked them that question. And then as I was then on standing by the pit wall, and then the cars come down the pit lane. And I remember seeing Jensen driving down the pit lane and just staring at it. And obviously having had this complicated view, because on the one hand, I could see that the rescue of Braun, or the team that was Honda to make it Braun, was a wonderful thing for Formula One. And for sport and for the world and for those 719 people who might otherwise have lost their jobs. On the other hand,
350 of them did. One has to say they slimmed it right down at that point.
Good point. And
Honda paid for that. Honda paid all the redundancy costs, which was not inconsiderable.
No, and a good point to make, Richard, but still sad, very sad for the 350
of course.
And their families and so on and so forth.
But amusingly, one of the things that went wrong at Melbourne was that this was the last season of refuelling, and their refuelling stops didn't go very well. And they realised that was because one of the 350 that they'd allowed to go, they'd given redundancy payments to, was the guy who'd been in charge of the fuel hose, and he knew how to, you know, ram the fuel hose in and then pull it off properly, and they didn't have anybody who was good at that. And he'd gone off to retrain as a plumber.
Really?
So for the rest of the season, they had to pay him a day rate plus expenses to come back for every race after Melbourne of the season to ensure that their refueling stops run well. So there are all sorts of that kind of stuff going on, you know, because they were only taking 40 all the way through the season. They were only taking 40 people to the races, whereas when it was Honda, they'd been taking 120.
Which underlines what we said initially. This was a fairy tale. This was this tiny team. And talking of the fairy tale, I remember standing on the pit wall next to the McLaren Pratt perch and seeing the car come down, Jensen driving. And then just seeing those 40 people who had been taken by Braun to, whether they were mechanics, engineers, very slim number of kind of ancillary people, marketing, catering, those types, all just running behind the car with tears streaming down their faces. And I find it emotional to describe now. And I remember staring at it and thinking, what a thing. And just standing there and clapping them, just clapping them because it was to be applauded.
Of course.
It was a remarkable, remarkable moment.
Yeah.
Sport can do that, you know, in a way that a lot of other things can't.
Yeah.
You know, rags to riches, whatever cliche you want to use. But
I mean, only a few weeks earlier, Ross Brawn and Nick Frye had paid the princely sum for the whole team of £1 to Honda, a token payment. And there they were, you know, first and second in the first Grand Prix of the championship season.
Humbling Ferrari, McLaren,
yes,
and all
totally.
The others.
Humiliating.
Humiliating. But it's interesting. Obviously, they paid £1, famously. But they were taking on further responsibility, including financial responsibility. So what degree of a risk do you think they were taking? Because it's not like just buying something for £1 and that's that.
Well, I think they're pretty shrewd. I think their wives worried about it. Jean Braun, Russell's
I think
wife,
they're okay now.
Yeah, they probably are, yes. Jean Braun didn't want their name on the car. I didn't want it to be a Braun Formula One car, but Ross got his way there. They were taking a risk because they were they had the livelihoods. Suddenly, they had the livelihoods of 350 people in their hands and quite a lot of obligations. I think when they got the Mercedes engine and they established very quickly a good relationship with Mercedes, then that would have reassured them quite considerably. But you know, all the way through the season, they were picking up sponsors piecemeal for each race, local sponsors, just to bring some kind of money in. And the amount, I think Nick Frye said that they won 6 out of the first 7 races, and I think the 10th race was the mid-season break, and Nick Frye said by that point they'd spent on development in Formula One goes on all the time, all the way through the season, that by the mid-season break, they'd spent a total of £600,000 on development. And he reckoned that's what Red Bull spent for every race, between every race. So that
amazing.
Was, it was hand to mouth. That was the fairy tale aspect.
It was. And as you say, they won 6 out of the first 7. So their first third of the season was astonishingly good.
Yeah.
Do you remember Jensen at Monaco stopping at the wrong place and running down the track?
Yes, having to run.
It was endlessly fairy tale kind of cinematic scenes that won.
Jensen won six. He was the person who won 6 of the first.
He won them.
And everybody thought he could walk on water at that point.
I know. Well, we didn't necessarily know. I mean, Jensen was always a good driver. Don't get me wrong. Deceptively smooth, deceptively rapid. But, Rubens had won more races than he had at that time. Obviously older, more experienced, been around longer.
Been in a Ferrari.
In a Ferrari, yes. And anyway, that's another podcast. But nonetheless, it was still impressive that when there was some winning to be done at that stage, Jensen did all of it in the first third of the season.
And he had had a checkered career up to that point. I mean, I was in the end of 1999, I was there for his famous shootout with Bruno Junqueira when Frank Williams was wondering who his second driver was going to be. And he got those two. And Junqueira at that point had a better record than Button. And I'm trying to remember now whether it was, I think it was at Jerez. And there was hardly anybody there. It was just, you know, one car.
You were there for the Guardian.
I was there for the guard room. you know, Jensen gave such a good account of himself at that shootout. And then, you know, he had a decent first season with Williams. But Williams wanted to bring Montoya in. So that kind of downgraded Jensen a bit immediately. Then he went,
Renault.
And Jensen's performance was very spotty at that point. And then he went to BAR Honda and won a race, didn't he, as you said, in 2006, which was a great thing. But then
a bit of a topsy. I think he qualified 14th or something, and it was rain-affected or weather-affected.
Now, that was the thing. He was always very good in the rain or in the damp.
Yes.
Very good in damp conditions.
Well, obviously, I worked with him at McLaren later.
Yep.
And I've never worked with someone who was so, I mean, I'm not an engineer, race engineer, but you hear the conversations on the headsets during the race. And Jensen was always on it. So he had a extraordinary ability to, whenever something weird was going on with the tyres, like, is it raining or is it spitting? It might start raining. It stopped again. It's raining at turn 4 and turn 5 and turn 6, but it's not raining at the end of the lap. All that kind of stuff. Everybody panics. All the, you know, the computer says no. Nobody really knows what to do. And what ended up happening is that Jensen would suddenly, the calm voice would come across the radio and he'd say something like, we're all right with Inters at this turns, but I've just watched and I've seen that Kimi is sliding at turn 16. And you think, how can you do that? Mm. How can you race a Formula One car in the wet and think about how your tyres are feeling and watch the big screens as you pass them and note something and then calmly pass it on? It was extraordinary. Mm. And then what one saw was that when conditions went like that, people used to copy Jensen. Other teams would say, Jensen's gone on slicks, let's try it.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was very, very good in those ways.
He was. I think the feeling at Braun about Jensen eventually was that, if the car had a performance advantage or, you know, was nice to drive and everything was going well, then he was terrific. It wasn't anybody better. But if there was a problem, and I think Nick Fry said that you'd know at the beginning of practice and qualifying that if Jensen suddenly started talking about problems in the car, you were in for a difficult weekend because he wasn't the person who was going to kind of drive around them or necessarily help find a solution to, you know, handling problems or whatever.
So I remember it at McLaren again, you know, front-end lockup. When he started talking about front-end lockup, you know, breaking into the corner, he was going to have a bad weekend.
Yeah. But, you know, he was the 6 out of 7 at the beginning of the season was pretty good. But then he, in Ross's words, started to wobble. And I wonder if there was a bit of imposter syndrome there. You know, suddenly you start thinking, am I supposed to be?
Do I deserve to be here?
Yes, think it secretly to yourself. Yes. You don't ever tell anybody that. But I just wonder, because his performances did dip. And, you know, he didn't win another race that season.
Whereas actually Rubens
won two. Yeah. Yep. And came on a bit stronger. So I wonder if it was there was a bit of that. And psychologically, Ross also said later on, he said, well, it's like when you're a football team and, you know, you're in a cup match or something and you're 3-0 up at half time, which is what Braun were effectively, then somehow, subconsciously, you don't play the second half in the same way. You know, you become more conservative. You try to
clinging on
to the advantage you work for.
Yeah.
So there may have been some of that there too.
It's funny. His football analogy is interesting because you got 3-0 up by attacking.
Yeah, Exactly.
So you should continue and win 6-0.
Yeah, but you put a couple of defenders on
yes.
and go into your shell and you hand the initiative to the other side. And of course, Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren didn't require any encouragement to take the initiative. And by the end of the season, the Red Bull with Vettel and Webber were clearly the class of the field.
Yes, and in fact, the performance that won Jensen the championship, we're now fast forwarding to the Brazilian Grand Prix, Interlagos, was a fifth place. I mean, a crucial fifth place because it earned him the points to be unassailable. But he was winning it by clinging on with small pickings.
Well, it was a fifth. It was a fifth place from 14th on the grid.
Yeah, it was a good drive.
And the 14th on the grid was not necessarily his fault because it had been a wet practice and, you know, he got out of sequence. But it was a fantastic drive.
Yeah.
There were three or four overtaking manoeuvres in it, which showed, you know, Interlagos is a great circuit for that.
Brilliant circuit.
It really is. It's a real theatre. And he took advantage of it. And, you know, and he was up to second at one point from 14.
Actually, you mentioned Interlagos. Received Wisdom says that among current tracks, this is another podcast, but I'll just say this sentence, Spa and Suzuka are the greatest. I think Interlagos is right up there.
Oh,
personally.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a terrific place.
Anyway, he did win the World Championship. And I remember actually in Interlagos, John Button, Papa Smurf, as some people call him. I never did call him Papa Smurf. Guess what, Richard? I bet you didn't.
I did not. I did not. But I did admire his pink shirts.
So did I. And lovely guy, utterly loyal to his son, and did much more to propel his son to Formula One from go-karting than people give him credit for, or than credit he demanded. A lovely person. And much missed. Anyway, I remember seeing him. I mean, he hugged everyone in the paddock that day. Absolutely everyone. But I remember seeing him in that congested, narrow Interlagos paddock. And I remember just pointing at him. I was McLaren, of course, but I was pointing at him. And he allowed himself to be pointed at with a broad grin. And I walked up to him. And, of course, I was one of the many people who hugged him. Everybody did. But I was so pleased.
Yeah. I wonder if you'd had a poll in the paddock that day, if you'd asked people, are you more pleased for Jensen or for John?
Close run thing.
It would have been, yes. Yeah, people really loved him.
Yeah. And it was just simple joy, you know, father and
Completely.
Son.
Yeah.
And think of where John had come from, quite humble origins. Yeah. And there he was, the king of the world.
Yeah, indeed.
It was great to see. Anyway, Tim Murnane, which is going back to McLaren's chief legal officer, his warnings came true because Mercedes had been the exclusive supplier to McLaren, but now they were thrilled with their new toy. They bought 75% of the Braun team. I think there was Emirati, Mubadala was the balance and others, but they bought a majority share. And of course, they then relaunched the team as Mercedes yeah. AMG F1, and we all know how successful that's been
yes.
in the ensuing 13 years.
With a deal which made Nick Frye and Ross Brawn, who'd taken such a risk with their pound coin at the beginning of the season, made them both rich beyond the dreams of avarice, one imagines.
Which is why I said, even though their wives may have been concerned in the first place, I doubt if they're concerned now.
Probably not.
No. So there we are. And I remember sitting in the hotel in Abu Dhabi, which was the last race of the year. And I think it was quite late at night on the Sunday. So people had had a drink or two, because why shouldn't they? It was the last race of the year. And I remember sitting and bumping into Richard Goddard, Jensen's manager. And I knew Richard quite well. So I said, you know, what a great season, mate. You must be so pleased. Here you are at the end of the year, sitting there, nice hotel, Abu Dhabi, glass of whatever. Fantastic. And he said, yeah, but I don't know about next year. You know, Merck want Michael Schumacher and we're not quite sure. And I said, well, really? Yeah, the world champion, reigning world champion. He said, well, you'd think, but I'm not quite sure. I said, well, talk to us. You know, we've got Lewis Hamilton and Heikki Kovalainen, And I don't know whether I can't remember whether we'd already announced or not, but we weren't going to retain Heikki Kovalainen. So I said, we got a vacancy. He said, you're going for Kimi, aren't you? Because Martin Whitmarsh, not necessarily the most discreet person, quite loose-lipped. And he had been talking about getting Kimi Räikkönen to join Lewis Hamilton, which would have been a stellar lineup at that time for 2010. And he was also talking to Nick Heidfeld, Martin Whitmarsh was. But I said, you know, I was thinking, obviously, from my role as well, comms, PR, if we had Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton, two, you know, Brits, two star drivers.
The last two world champions.
The last two world champions. When has that happened?
Yep.
That, you know, you've got somebody, the last two world champions come together for the next, you'll probably find a time and you'll tell me it happened in 1950-something.
No.
But it was remarkable. And I thought that's an opportunity. And I said, you know, send me an email and I'll get you together. And anyway, I went back to Woking and spoke to Martin Whitmarsh and Ron Dennis about it. But they thought, that's not going to happen. Definitely Mercedes will hang on. And then I actually remember sitting, waiting outside Ron's office to see him, which, by the way, is one of my abiding memories of my 10 years there, is sitting outside Ron's office waiting to see him, because he always keeps you waiting.
Well, at least you know you're waiting in a clean, well-lighted place with the temperature at 21 degrees.
Always 21 and certainly clean, yes. Anyway, I was sitting there and Martin walked past. Hello, Matt. But he was actually looking for Justine Bowen, who was Ron's PA, because he wanted a phone number. And he said, Justine, do you happen to have the phone number of John Byfield? And I thought, why would he want the phone number of John Byfield? And nosily, I said, I'm just wondering why you want the number of John Byfield. He said, well, you know, you've talked to me about this and you know, might hire Jenson Button, might talk to his manager. I said, he hasn't been his manager for years. I can put you in touch with Richard Goddard, who is his manager, which then duly happened. And obviously the story ran out and Jenson came to the McLaren Technology Center at an ungodly time, I think Friday evening at 8 o'clock at night when it was quiet, walked around and, I mean, the McLaren Technology Center always blows everybody's mind if they've not been there before. I remember Jenson saying, why don't you win everything in this incredible place? Anyway, we ended up with Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton at McLaren. Great lineup, stellar lineup. And we then had to work out how to communicate it, when to announce it, etc. But the relationship with Mercedes, between Mercedes and McLaren, had already become a bit strained because they had duly bought the team that was their new pride and joy toy. And we then decided we should work out when to announce it and also when to alert the Braun people and the Mercedes people. And we decided, I can't remember, let's say it was 9 o'clock, normal time you'd send a press release out on whatever day it was. And I remember the decision being to let Nick Fry and Ross Braun know just before. I mean just before, quarter of an hour before. Quite aggressive to give so little timing. And it wasn't my role, of course, to do that. That was handled by Martin Whitmarsh. Anyway, I remember, and I was at home getting ready to go to work, and my phone rang, and it was Nick Fry, and it was after our announcement had gone out, or perhaps just before, in that little gap between his having been alerted and the... Anyway, he said, I know you're not necessarily, you know, the person I should be talking to. I've tried to call Ron. I've tried to call Martin. Neither of them will answer their bloody phone. So next person I thought of was you. And then he launched into a tirade. And this is a family show, Richard. So I can't use the words, but am I allowed to say that some began with F and one began with C?
What, smiling Nick Fry spoke to you those terms?
Yes.
I'm astonished.
He called me those things, which actually I wear as a badge of honour. I like Nick, by the way, I like Nick. And we've had chats about it since, but I think he was just incredibly frustrated and angered and annoyed that he couldn't get through to Ron and Martin. Thought they were probably fielding his call, which they probably were, and then thought, right, who else do I know? I know, Bishop. And gave me both barrels.
I think they'd wanted to keep Jensen. He was their world champion. He was their boy, and he was liked at the factory and by the team. They were certainly going to replace Rubens. And they'd approached Nico Rosberg to take the second seat in what would become the Mercedes team the next season. But, of course, Jensen going opened the door for Michael Schumacher to come back in, which, of course, suited Mercedes' purposes very well. But was it grabbing Jensen, was that Ron's revenge for Braun taking the Mercedes engine in any sense, do you think?
I don't actually think so. I think it was when it became clear that actually Jensen was available, because when I first mentioned it to Martin Whitmarsh, he poo-pooed the idea. Mm-hmm. He said, no, they won't get rid of him, living in cloud cuckoo land, Matt. But anyway, I think then it was just a pragmatic decision, which was, hang on a minute, what a lineup. And Jensen, in some ways, had some of his best years, actually, at McLaren. But that's another podcast as well. So, I mean, you know, we're coming up towards the end. And I suppose, you know, we talked about a fairy tale. We talked about, you know, is this the most feel-good story in Formula One history? I don't know whether we put it at number one, but it's up there, isn't it, Richard?
It is. And it was just a fascinating season all round, because there was a war going on between Bernie Eccleston and Max Mosley and the teams, which was eventually resolved. There was Bernie versus Silverstone, trying to get the British Grand Prix moved to Donington, which you know, Silverstone eventually found a way out of by spending a lot of money. And there are all these things going on. It was a very, very, it was almost feverish kind of season. But there was this amazing narrative on top of it that nobody had seen coming.
And I think that's, I think nobody had quite seen that coming. And I think it is probably, is it, Richard, a time to call a halt to our first podcast?
I guess. I mean, we could go on. But that's probably a good place to call time on our first episode of And Colossally, That's History. We'll be back next week with another in-depth discussion about a different topic. But in the meantime, if you enjoyed the show, please do follow or subscribe to the feed so you never miss an episode. And even better, please tell a friend if you think they'd enjoy it.
Please do tell all your friends. And if you want to get in touch with us on the show, you can do so. Drop us a line on podcasts@the-race.com. Or you can drop Richard or me a message on Twitter. Call it X if you must. I'm at the Bish F1 and Richard is at R. Williams 1947, the last digits of which may or may not be a significant date in his life or indeed birth. Until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
And colossally, that's history.
The Athletic.